support them and continue to support them despite the unequal balance of power, this asymmetrical warfare, and the immense casualties on humanitarian, on Yemeni lives over the last several years. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who are starving to death, who have starved to death already or have been killed by the violence, millions of people who still rely on aid. The blockade is still in effect, although parts of it has been partially lifted. You know, Yemenis still continue to suffer despite the ceasefire. Because, you know, bombs weren't killing most people. The blockade has been killing most people and continues to kill most people in Yemen. Saudi Arabia has not suffered the consequences of this war. They've been engaging in this war in Yemen. Them and the UAE have been occupying parts of Yemen and using its resources. And yet here in the U.S., we're not able to, you know, face our own complicity after all of these years. We're not able to say, well, we really should not be engaging in these war crimes. You know, Senator Murphy and Senator Sanders spoke on the floor and they talked about any form of U.S. support is not acceptable. Any form, whether it's intelligence sharing or logistics training or, you know, weapon deals, none of this should be happening. And yet here we are all of these years later, unable to come to the conclusion that we really should be ending U.S. complicity. You know, this is the bare minimum that we can do and we're not there yet.
Shireen Al-Adeimi, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Yemeni American assistant professor at Michigan State University, non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Renee Feltz. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right. 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. You can always make a donation to help keep KBOO independent and non-commercial at kboo.fm/give. Right now, during our end-of-year drive, is the perfect time to contribute. Give now and help us reach our goal of $70,000 by December 31st. Make your tax-deductible year-end donation at kboo.fm/give today.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programmings of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website, kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Governance and Policy Committee meets quarterly on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify that a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, Oregon gets a nearly $700 million pollution settlement from Monsanto.
Multnomah County won't fund Mayor Ted Wheeler's controversial mass homeless encampment plan.
And labor advocates call on Congress to fund the National Labor Relations Board.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 16th, 2022. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Ashley Mackey.
And I'm Josh Salem. Oregon will get nearly $700 million in a pollution settlement from Bayer, the company that owns Monsanto. The lawsuit concerned the industrial chemical polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCB, that came from products made by agricultural company Monsanto. Oregon is now the latest U.S. state to receive millions of dollars in damages from the company for pollution allegedly caused by the chemicals. It's the largest environmental damage recovery in Oregon's history, and is much larger than any other state settlement over PCB contamination by Monsanto. Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum says that the decision is vitally important to the state's land, air, water, wildlife, and residents. According to Bayer, the settlement fully resolves all of Oregon's claims and releases the company from any future liability. The Oregon agreement also contains no admission of liability or wrongdoing by the company. The lawsuit was brought in 2018, and the case went to trial in May. Initial hearings were held, but the case was settled once the trial began. Bayer acquired Monsanto in 2018, and has also reached agreements totaling more than $275 million to resolve similar lawsuits with the attorney generals of Washington State, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Ohio, and Washington, D.C. Oregon's $698 million settlement is the largest by far, more than seven times the size of the second largest settlement of $95 million reached with Washington State in 2020.
The chemical in question here, PCBs, had a lot of industrial and commercial uses like paint, coolants, sealants, and hydraulic fluids. Monsanto produced them from 1935 until 1977, 2 years before they were banned by Congress for being bad for the environment. In Oregon, more than two dozen rivers and streams have tested positive for PCBs, and at least 40 watersheds have been affected. PCBs cause a variety of bad health effects, including cancer in animals and likely humans, and they have a negative impact on immune, reproductive, and nervous systems. Fish species in Oregon are especially vulnerable because the chemicals collect in their fatty tissues. When seals, eagles, osprey, orca whales, and humans eat those fish, it is possible that contamination is passed on. The settlement money will go toward environmental improvement projects across the state, including natural resource restoration, air and water quality improvements, contaminated site cleanups, and wildlife habitat protections. The Oregon Department of Justice say they will work with the legislature, the governor, and state agencies to decide how to allocate the funds. Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum is excited to bring a settlement of this size to the state. She said, quote, "When we start digging and understanding what is in our land, what is in our water, it can really bring tears to your eyes. So let's get this cleaned up so that our kids and our grandkids will not have tears in their eyes," end quote.
The Multnomah County Commission will spend $28 million on rental assistance, not Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler's controversial mass homeless encampment plan. The commission voted unanimously on Thursday on how to budget these one-time funds to support residents at risk of or experiencing homelessness. Evictions have shot up in Multnomah County. In 2019, there were an average of 500 evictions a month. In October, there were 820. Data compiled by Portland State University show 90% of these evictions were because of non-payment of rent. $15 million will help fill a gap in rental assistance that could prevent 3,400 households from being evicted by June. Another million will go towards financial assistance, like move-in costs and security deposits, to get 300 more people into permanent supportive housing. The commission will put $12 million in a contingency fund to help fill future gaps in houseless services. Mayor Wheeler asked the county commission to put $21 million toward his controversial plan to build mass homeless encampments and force unhoused people to live in them. He also threatened to hold hostage needed funding for the Joint Office of Homeless Services, a city and county partnership. That means budget cuts and a pause on developing a county-run women's shelter. Commissioner Sushila Jayapal said, quote, "Partnership is essential, but partnership requires working collaboratively to construct a plan, not a five-minute phone call to announce a plan that has been created. And partnership is most definitely not threats and ultimatums. That's the kind of partnership and leadership our constituents expect and deserve," end quote. Mayor Wheeler and Commissioner Dan Ryan released a statement expressing their disappointment in the commission's decision.
The Senate is urged to act quickly to avoid a government shutdown, but passes a record-breaking National Defense Authorization Act. And a home COVID-19 test will temporarily become available again as cases rise this winter. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
No drama, no gridlock, no delay. That's the recipe right now for avoiding a shutdown within the next 48 hours, and I'm very hopeful we'll get that done with time to spare.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is urging senators to act quickly to avoid a government shutdown. On Wednesday night, the House passed the one-week stopgap measure, which extends government funding until December 23rd. It's now up to the Senate to make sure it passes before funding ends Friday at midnight. The Senate on Thursday authorized an $858 billion National Defense Authorization Act for 2023 in an 83-11 vote. The bill is around $45 billion more than President Joe Biden wanted and consequently undoes the mandate for troops to receive COVID vaccines. This comes as a win for Republicans who argue mandating vaccines for the military could create retention instability surrounding the issue.
Today, we're opening up covidtest.gov for a limited time this winter to give Americans another easy option to access testing when there is a greater need, as there is right now.
White House COVID-19 response coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha announced the temporary reopening of the free at-home COVID test program as cases continue to rise across the nation, especially for those older than 65. Pressure continues to mount on Congress as victims' families urge lawmakers to change gun laws to prevent future mass shootings.
This debatable topic on assault rifles should not be brought up again because someone else's child or sibling was murdered. It's just an excuse at this point.
Faith Mata's fourth-grade sister, Tess, was killed in the Uvalde school shooting earlier this year. She asked members of Congress when enough will be enough. On Thursday, the House passed a historic bill that could permit Puerto Ricans to determine the island's future political status. The legislation passed 233-191 and now heads to the Senate. Arizona Democratic Representative and House Natural Resources Chair Raul Grijalva helped introduce the bill, despite him saying it wasn't easy.
It incorporates expertise and knowledge from a wide range of stakeholders who have grappled with the dilemma of Puerto Rico's second-class political status for many, many years.
The Senate is unlikely to hear the bill before the end of the year and is also unlikely to pick up the support needed. Some view the bill as symbolic as it ushers in the potential for the Caribbean island to decide whether to become a state, declare independence, or create a sovereign government aligned to the U.S. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Hey, how are you? Well, they're two different.
A Portland police sergeant was arrested and charged with third-degree sex abuse and harassment on Thursday. Officer Dirk Hull allegedly grabbed a woman's groin and pulled her hair, apparently unprovoked, at Toby's Sports Pub in Metzger in October. Hull has been on the police force for 23 years and was off-duty at the time of the alleged crime. He was cited and released, authorities say. Portland Police Chief Chuck Lovell said in a statement, quote, "As law enforcement officers, we are held to a higher standard. In order to preserve the public trust, we are informing the community of this incident," end quote. Portland police say they have put Hull on administrative leave and are conducting an internal investigation.
TriMet expands its ability to ban riders from public transit outside of the criminal justice system. The board voted on Wednesday to expand rider penalties for people who commit crimes on TriMet and people who violate TriMet policies frequently. The agency's general manager can now ban riders who threaten the safety of others and those who repeatedly litter or sleep on buses and trains repeatedly. It's part of a push by the Public Transit Agency to promote a sense of safety on the transit system. A feeling of safety is a part of their strategy to attract people back to TriMet, since low ridership levels haven't bounced back since the beginning of the pandemic. TriMet has a lot of discretion about what can get someone banned off transit and for how long. This only applies to behavior-based offenses, though, like smoking, littering, and excessive noise, not fare evasion. Already, those convicted of felonies or Class A misdemeanors on public transit can face bans. Riders who get banned can appeal, however. TriMet legal counsel Eric Van Hagen said, quote, "An important aspect of our approach is to get people off the system when there is a security threat, but then give them the opportunity to get back on when there is a changed behavior end quote. In 2022, TriMet doubled the amount of safety supervisors and increased the number of security officers riding the system.
The National Labor Relations Board's budget has been frozen since 2014, but unionization is increasing and straining the agency. The NLRB told Congress that without a funding increase, it will have to cut staff at its headquarters and 48 regional offices across America. The agency's caseload is up 23% over last year, but the agency staff has been reduced by 30% over the last decade. Brett Pivato has the details.
With a wave of unionization sweeping across America, the agency that oversees labor relations is struggling to keep up. The National Labor Relations Board is funded by Congress, and its budget is unchanged since fiscal year 2014. Over time, inflation has eaten into that figure to the point that now the agency is effectively operating with a 25% lower budget than 9 years ago. This is in contrast with the growing caseload the agency is addressing thanks to increasing unionization. Sarah Steffens with the Communications Workers of America says without additional funding, the agency may have to cut staff.
The agency is seeing a lot of work responding to these election petitions and to employer misbehavior. And at the same time, they're contemplating the need to potentially do a furlough of their employees.
The NLRB warned Congress in a letter in November that the current funding level is impairing their ability to maintain staff capacity at their headquarters and 48 field offices across the nation. The work of the NLRB includes both union representation cases and investigating unfair labor practices. The number of both types of cases has increased with the total caseload up 23% over last year. Yet, over the last decade, the total number of personnel at the NLRB has declined by 30%. The NLRB letter to Congress says the staff reduction and increasing caseload is slowing down case processing to the detriment of both employers and employees. Stephan says workers with claims against employers are dependent on this one agency.
Really, there is only one place, the National Labor Relations Board, that protects workers in these situations. So if they are underfunded, it's like tying the government's hand behind its back when it comes to enforcing labor laws.
Union advocates are calling for Congress to appropriate $368 million to fund the NLRB next year. With union organizing on an upswing, public sentiment about unions is as well, with a Gallup poll this year showing the highest level of approval for unions since 1965. Steffens believes the labor organizing will continue.
This is a wave of organizing that is not stopping. The rate of winning union elections is up, I want to say it's 71% over the course of the first part of this year.
For Maryland News Connection, I'm Brett Pivato.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 32 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny, clear, and gusty with a daytime high of 41. Today in history, in 1773, the Boston Tea Party took place, where American colonists crudely disguised as Native Americans threw 342 chests of tea belonging to the British East India Company into Boston Harbor to protest a tax on tea. The quote of the day is from English novelist Jane Austen, who was born today in 1775. Austen wrote, quote, "Selfishness must always be forgiven, you know, because there is no hope for a cure."
A proposal in the New York State Legislature would remove the National Rifle Association's ability to certify people who teach gun safety courses. This raises some questions about what people are taught in firearms training and who should be responsible for certifying the instructors. Edwin J. Vieira has more.
A bill before the New York State Legislature would remove the National Rifle Association's ability to certify gun safety instructors. Under Senate Bill 9601, New York State's Department of Criminal Justice Services would develop a curriculum for gun safety training. The legislation comes several months after the Supreme Court struck down the state's concealed carry laws, which required that a person show proper cause to want to carry a gun. State Senator Sean Ryan, who introduced the bill, says it was brought forward because of the NRA's support for that lawsuit. He describes what he hopes the training would cover.
I would hope if the Department of Criminal Justice Services makes up their curriculum, that they will then train New Yorkers about how to safely store their guns, the responsibility of a gun owner vis-a-vis children in the house, but also to go over places where guns are and are not allowed in New York State.
Ryan adds he's seen opposition from the New York State Pistol and Rifle Association. In the long term, he's convinced passing the bill would create a safer New York. The bill is currently in the Senate Rules Committee. Ryan says he hopes the new curriculum would mean gun safety instructors could also better inform people about how stolen guns end up on the street.
There would be a greater emphasis on safe storage. New York has a variety of safe storage laws that make you store your firearm in secure locations. In fact, you have a child living in your house, somebody with a criminal record living in your house, and also to train on the dangers of suicide from gun.
Ryan says overall he just wants to ensure that gun owners in the state exercise a high standard of care and safety with firearms. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, New York already has a relatively low rate of firearm deaths. Statewide, they numbered 1,052 in 2020. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, New York News Connection.
A bill in Congress will repeal 11 federal laws that discriminate against Native Americans, and two South Dakota congressmen led the charge. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Congress is passing a bill that repeals 11 federal laws that discriminate against Native Americans. Two Republican members of South Dakota's congressional delegation pushed the bill forward, Senator Mike Rounds and Representative Dusty Johnson. Lee Strubinger has more.
One of the federal laws the Respect Act repeals is one that requires Native American children be stripped from their families and forcing them into boarding schools. South Dakota U.S. Senator Mike Rounds has introduced the bill as far back as 2015. Then it failed to make it out of committee. Now it's been passed by the Senate and House. It repeals laws dealing with forced separation and abolishing certain treaty rights, among others. Rounds says he's pleased the bill passed.
We need to clean up some of this legislation that's been around for more than a century and that really disrespected Native Americans throughout the United States. And so the opportunity to eliminate these 11 laws, it sends a good message that, number one, not only do we recognize that they were wrong to begin with, but second of all, to do something about it.
Rounds says the bill sends a message to tribes from Congress that it wants to right some wrongs of the past. The bill has support from the Great Plains Tribal Chairmen's Association and National Congress of American Indians. It now heads to President Joe Biden's desk. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger.
Meanwhile, a powerful storm can't keep fans from attending the Lakota Nation Invitational in Rapid City. South Dakota Public Broadcasting CJ Keene reports the annual event is as popular as ever.
Wind gusts over 60 miles an hour and snow descended upon the entire state, negatively affecting driving conditions the day before the tournament started. Brian Brewer is the founder of the LNI, which is in its 45th year. He says the blizzard brought an unexpected wrinkle.
A lot of the fans just came up early. Right now we have fans back home are calling, and they're trying to get up here, hopefully tomorrow, to watch the games. Many of them are watching it on pay-per-view. Last year, the 4 days, I forget how many we sold for 4 days for pay-per-view. We sold that same number in the first 4 hours of the first day.
Brewer says there's a deep connection to the tournament.
We have our third generation of kids. And we have boys that are playing, their grandfathers played in the tournament when we first started, you know. So it's really something, and you can see the excitement and how proud they are, you know, representing their school. It's really a good feeling just to watch our kids.
Brewer says decades in, the LNI continues to gain popularity. He says finding space for other events is still a challenge. That's despite Rapid City completing a new arena last year.
Last year was our first year in the Summit Arena. with the addition of the summit that has really helped us. There's a lot of other activities that we would like to do, but we don't have enough room. So we're trying to figure out how to get those other venues starting.
The LNI runs through this Saturday. For National Native News in Rapid City, I'm CJ Keene.
A hospital on the Navajo Nation in Arizona is seeking the public's help as it's being overloaded with patients with the flu, RSV, and COVID-19. The Tuba City Regional Healthcare Corporation says the combination of cases are filling up hospital beds and other hospitals in the state, especially with respiratory illnesses among children. The increased demand in care is putting a strain on the healthcare system, and to deal with the surge, a second clinic has been opened for adult urgent care. Doctors are asking the public to consider their options for care, including telemedicine visits. Health officials are also encouraging people to wear masks in public. A mask mandate on the Navajo reservation is still in place. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A recent report says the time it takes to earn the cost of paying for food, gas, and housing is cutting into many college students' ability to complete their studies. KBOO's Reed Johnson has more on that story.
Covering the cost of a college education just got more expensive, as already stressed students cope with the highest inflation rate in more than 40 years. A new report finds that while direct expenses like tuition and fees are on the rise, so are indirect costs like housing, gas, and groceries. Many students in Indiana and across the nation are working multiple jobs just to pay for life's necessities. Maya Bell is a sophomore at Purdue University Northwest in Hammond. She says her studies as a double major in political science and human development are hard work, but paying for living expenses is becoming harder.
I used to spend $50 on groceries, and now I spend like $100. Gas is crazy. $40 doesn't even get me close to a full tank. I think there's just a lot of smaller factors that impede my academic and my professional work because I'm trying to make enough money to like live.
Bell is a scholarship student who lives in a campus dormitory, but says earning money to pay for items like clothing, car payments, and even vet bills for a cat cut into time she normally sets aside for her studies. A blog post by the National Scholarship Providers Association says to cover higher expenses, many colleges are raising tuition rates and student service fees. All the while, interest costs and tuition loans have almost doubled over the past 2 years. Bell says making ends meet can be a struggle, but she finds creative ways to cope.
It's just hard, more of the fact, like working like almost three jobs because it doesn't give you enough time to dedicate to school and studying as you would like to. So it's like I'm staying up all night now because I can't really work during the day on my schoolwork.
According to the report, many colleges across the country are making changes to help students save money. Some are allowing students to attend classes virtually one day a week or providing free public transportation to cut down on commuting costs. Others provide free groceries or have loaner programs for students who can't afford laptops. Bell says she's looking at 3 more years of work before graduation.
I always make it work, but it's not ideally how I want it to work. I have to go to the food pantry at my school, or I have to ask my parents for help. And I've also picked up a side job babysitting, but I don't see myself getting out of the situation anytime soon.
For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Reed Johnson.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 16th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, Josh Salem, and Reed Johnson. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Alex Gonzalez, and Brett Pivato. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Ashley Mackey. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, so now is a great time to get involved. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kbu.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, when the Keystone Pipeline spilled hundreds of thousands of gallons of hard-to-clean, sludgy oil in Kansas, AP's headline explained that the disaster, quote, raises questions, close quote, about the pipeline's operation. The utterly predictable harms of fossil fuel companies are forever raising questions for elite media. What in the world would happen if they were seen as answering them and calling for a requisite response? We'll talk about the latest revelations about fossil fuel industry lying about climate change with Richard Wiles, president of the Center for Climate Integrity. Also on the show, as powerful people call loudly for a post-COVID return to normal, many are demanding we acknowledge that not only are we not post-COVID,